Welcome, Red Eyes members. Welcome back. We are talking with Eilas Kefas. Thank you very much for joining us. We're having a very interesting conversation here about, I think, thoughts, basically, that many people will and I think should have as they're involved in a lot of this consuming of information, as it were. A lot of people are just... in a way, they're just making up for lost time, it seems like, and many people are so hungry for all this kind of esoteric, occult, conspiratorial information, and I think it's a very good thing at the end of the day, at least, and what people make of it is up to themselves, basically, at that point. But definitely there should be there is a responsibility in both ways, both those who disseminate and both those who receive the information, obviously. But I'm going to ask you a little bit more here, Eilas, of what you'll be doing in regards to when you're turning away from the web entirely. You're going to put down your blog then, or you know, not update it, I guess. And same thing with your podcast. You think it will be difficult to face that out? Will you still sneak peek, as it were, on the web, or are you going to try just you know, throw away your computer and everything?
No, I won't be taking that drastic measures. I'll just be exercising a little self-control. I'm definitely I've made it clear that I'm still open to private correspondences. It's not like I'm abandoning the field. It's really sort of going to more subtler kind of process, I think, and more inward, as I've mentioned. I also have to work on, well, I don't have to, but I'm going to be working on a new book about the military entertainment industry and that whole area, which is going to take up a lot of time. So, I mean, there were various just basic pragmatic reasons for this. Another being that I simply need to get a job. I can't make a living doing podcasts and blogging, unfortunately. And, there's something to be said for the duties of maintaining one's physical being, whether it's ill health or financial instability or what have you. It definitely helps to keep us grounded.
Yeah, that's true. And we need to survive. We need to eat. We need to have a roof over our heads. And that's the rules of the current game on this planet, as we talked about before. And that's what the masters are doing in that sense, and that's the situation we find ourselves in. And unfortunately, maybe perhaps, but again, I feel that we're also in a period where new ideas are coming to light, new ways of working out, outside the main currency, things like that. There is a lot of ideas. Do you feel kind of excited for these times in regards to, if we think about it financially, at least, considering the bad state of the financial system, that new things will pop up because of this and new initiatives will be taken? Or do you think that we'll just kind of be more enslaved by it all, Eilas?
Well, what enslaves us is our own habits, our own desires, our own identities. So I'm not too concerned about the kind of mass enslavement programs that we see going on in the world, because I very much see this in a sense as a positive step in the way that World War II was potentially a positive process of, again, awakening of the shadow. It allows us to see the true nature of our chains, of our darkness, of our distortion when these things actually become realized at a physical level. And so I do see this potentially as a positive thing, that more and more people are becoming aware of the world in which we live. I see that that mankind has been enslaved for many thousands of years at a subtler metaphysical level. And so what we're experiencing now as a species, in a sense, it's like we're owning up to this reality now. But of course, you could also see it as that it's reaching its final phase, where it's actually becoming, the machinery is going to be in place for everyone to see, and it will actually come down to whether you take the implant or whether you don't. This is the narrative that we've created. But I think, and so anyone who is not able to take that narrative and take responsibility for the situation that we've landed in is going to wind up enslaved And but then we're already enslaved. That's the thing. And this actually is a possibility, an opportunity, I think, for us to become free, is to actually be able to see the nature of our enslavement. That gives us the challenge. But it's a very tricky thing, because if we see it as an external thing, as this nefarious demonic plot, then we're going to resist it, and resistance makes stronger.
Yes.
We're going to fight it, and then we're going to give our energy to it. And this is exactly what, I don't want to say what they want, because the point I'm trying to make is there isn't really a they, but this is exactly what's kept us enslaved for this long, is this refusal to simply open to and embrace our own shadow, you know, and take responsibility for the situation. And then it can actually transform, then it can begin to transform. I think this is getting very close to the quick of the problem I have, if I can use that phrase, with the whole conspiracy community and the whole the memes and the narratives are being created, is that they are basically negative. And I don't mean that in the sense, oh, they're dark. Of course, they have to be dark.
Mm-hmm.
That's also my point, that there's an awful lot of darkness and distortion, an unimaginable amount that we haven't owned up to, and that has to be acknowledged and dealt with. Yeah. So I don't mean that, but what I mean is that it's being framed in such a way that our response to it has to be negative. It's feeding us all of these different ideas and realities and agendas that we are then supposed to say no to. We're supposed to resist, fight the New World Order, you know,
yeah,
overcome the enemy. And so it's actually creating in us this state of resistance and defiance, which is the inverse, I think, of the energy that we actually need to tune into now as a species, which is the energy of surrender, the energy of opening. Of opening to life and everything, you know, whatever it is, because it's all part of the same thing. And we can't, I mean, surely we've seen now that we can't overcome evil by fighting it and resisting it.
Hmm. I'm thinking of something I've heard actually many people talk about, and that's the idea of send George Bush and the rest of the boys some love, because they need it the most. And that's something that I've heard for a long time. And in one sense, I understand it absolutely in that sense. I mean, it's about, if George W. Bush represents this kind of unconscious force in ourselves, or that, as Paul Levy elaborates on, that we kind of collectively have placed him up there as an archetype for everyone to project either their admiration or hate for, or whatever it might be. The only way to kind of deal with that is to integrate him or what he represents in that sense. So we need to identify it in ourselves and show it some love instead of trying to push it further away. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that sounds exactly right. I mean, I would see that these so-called malevolent agents and agencies, these are the disowned fragments of the collective psyche, which have like become autonomous, and so they've become they're going counter to the flow. It's like the Lucifer myth, you know, the rebellion. They'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven.
Yes.
So if we see these agencies and these agendas as these aspects of the collective psyche that have become disowned, rejected, and thereby unruly, uncontrollable, they're like children. They're like very spoiled, very deformed or distorted children who are just behaving in these hideous, aberrational ways. And yeah, they need, a child needs love and discipline. It's
right.
Not just this new age thing of you know. I mean, loving your enemy, what's it in the Bible? Love your enemy because it will be as hot coals upon his head. That's the thing. I mean, that's the one thing that the demon or the demonic element, let's say, it can't resist, you see, because I don't want to get cheesy here with the power of love, but it's the universal energy of acceptance and of surrender. And I think a key is really, and this does relate to the agendas that many of your guests talk about, is that the demonic element, let's say, it can't actually do anything to us as consciousness, which is what we are, you know. And that includes the physical sabotage and all the rest of it. All of that is just a way of trying to hijack our or sabotage our consciousness through our DNA, through our bodies. It can't do anything to us, but what it can do is it can cause us to do things to ourselves as a reaction to what we perceive is being done to us.
Yes.
You see what I mean by that? So if we resist and we flinch from the demonic, then we contract and we tighten up and we go into the space of fear and of loathing. And so then we do end up sabotaging our own gnosis and our own harmony, you know, the harmony within ourselves. And so the demonic element thereby has been successful. Whereas if we open to it, and totally, and manifest love and acceptance towards it, then it becomes utterly powerless.
Hmm. You know, I'm also wondering, as you're mentioning some of these things here, I'm wondering what it is in us that also perceives a problem as a problem, instead of just an experience or something. Okay, with recognition that this is something I like or this is something that I dislike. I understand that, but when we perceive it as a problem, we begin to struggle with it. And we, again, as you mentioned here many times now, we see it as something externally and we begin our little fight or dance with it, however we want to look at that. But we don't really just accept this for what it is. And in that sense, if you accept the experience or the problem, that is a kind of what I see, at least, as a kind of an acceptance of it, a type of, this is how you dissolve the problem. This is that, okay, I recognize it's there. I do have issues with it, but I'm going to try not to let it affect me in that way. I'm just going to, you know, try to work with it and maybe even turn it around. See, okay, am I doing something wrong in this situation to bring this problem about? You know, I think that these are the types of things that we need to work with in order to actually solve these things that we perceive as problems. So I don't know what you think about ideas like that, Eilas.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a problem, so-called, is only a problem to the local awareness of the identity, which has an idea about the way it wants things to be, and will allow that idea to conflict with what is. It will impose. That's what we do. We have preference. If we want to have a gala party in the garden, then we don't like the fact that it rains. Somewhere else, a farmer is delighted that it's raining because his crops are going to grow. It's just a point of view. If we've decided that we want things to be a certain way, then anything that interferes with that is going to be perceived as a problem.
Yes.
But clearly that's a very egocentric point of view, which is not to say that it's invalid. I mean, we do need to have egos, we do need to perceive things from a particular way, but we don't have to identify with that perception and be restricted to it. Just as if we have a preference for this or that kind of food or whatever, it doesn't mean that that's all we're going to eat. It doesn't mean we're going to be demanding little brats who won't eat up their vegetables. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's kind of a metaphor for how we are as adults. We don't want to eat the Brussels sprouts. We want things on our terms, and we refuse to understand, you know, that this is good for us kind of thing. Even if we know it's true, we say, well, I don't care. It's good for us because I want things on my terms. I want them my way. And that's, you don't have to be a raving egomaniac to be like that. We are simply all programmed in that way to have a preference and then to forge an allegiance to that preference so that we will kind of perceive anything that goes against it or that prevents us from having that as a threat, as a problem that needs to be solved. So then life becomes a series of problems.
Hmm.
You know? But then if you really look at it, the problem is us, isn't it? The problem is that point of view that simply won't deal with what is.
Do you believe that's, that... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Do you believe that we have more than one life? Or how do we progress and learn? Because what I'm also getting at from what you're describing here is that this is, again, this is this process that we have to go through this particular period in order to understand and learn it. But on top of that, I guess you can add this idea or theory about possible reincarnation, that we are having multiple trial runs here, so to speak, in order to actually learn and propel this. Do you think that's the case, or do you think that this is all about the unconscious growing and our kind of collective memory that is slowly learning?
Yeah, I think the latter is a much healthier model, Henry, because to me the reincarnation model just reeks of egotism again. This idea that I was Adolf Hitler in a past life, or whoever, it doesn't actually hold up. I mean, never mind that if one looks into the statistics and all the rest of it, reincarnation couldn't possibly apply to everyone anyway. So if it does, if it is a reality, then it's very selective. But even beyond that, I mean, who is this I that we're referring to as reincarnating? Because if I was Adolf Hitler in the past life, then I wasn't I. You know, that means Adolf Hitler is now me. No, it's a paradox in itself, or a contradiction. And I think it's, again, it's what we talked about in the first hour, this irresistible temptation to frame and sort of distort, interpret the unknown in terms that we can understand, in terms of the known. And so we do intuit that as consciousness we have an existence above and beyond this identity. And so then we create this very linear model of a soul that incarnates, reincarnates on this sort of journey to knowledge. And it, but again, if you look at that, that's a very worldly model, isn't it? It's basically based on our idea of higher learning and, you know, colleges and hierarchies and structures. And, you know, why would we think that, you know, the cosmic unknowable structure of creation would somehow parallel our own worldly structures, when we also know that our worldly structures are totally distorted and non-functioning, and, you know, we basically see them as a big lie and a big snare. So the universe has to be infinitely more subtle and mysterious than anything that we can interpret in such a linear way. Hence your idea of the collective. I mean, that's definitely how I choose to see it, that we are, you, Henrik, I, Aeolus, we are fragments of consciousness that belongs to a greater morphogenetic field of consciousness, which is the species, which is linked to the Earth, which is part of the solar system, and so on, ad infinitum. So we're actually just local points of view in a collective intelligence system, a greater intelligence system, which is actually unified, a universe. And so we're all constantly reincarnating, you know. Yes. That energy is constantly taking new forms, but there's nothing personal about it.
There was something that slipped my mind here now that I wanted to ask you about. Let's see here. It was about the idea that, do you think that we are refining ourselves or the unconscious all the time then, or do you think that we're in a kind of a devolutionary process, if we use a term of Michael Cremo?
Well, I think that we are being refined, or consciousness is being refined through this physical experience of organic life. I think the species itself, it appears to be, it seems to be a mutation process. I think that collectively the species is devolving in terms of awareness and the refinement of consciousness, but that this is actually an alchemical process by which the gold is being drawn from the lead. And so as the gold nuggets are emerging, the lead is being reduced. So you take a lot of lead to make a little bit of gold. And in terms of consciousness, I think Neil Cramer talks about this, and I think he's one of the only people to put his finger on this, that consciousness is actually going where it is welcome, in a sense. It's like the biblical saying that to he who has will be given, and to he who has not will be taken, even that little that he has. Those of us who are able to wield consciousness, to align with consciousness, and actually embody, you know, this galactic frequency or spirit or whatever it is, we'll be receiving more and more of it, not personally. It's like water that flows where it can.
Yes.
We're creating a space for it, and this consciousness fills. But this consciousness must come from somewhere. And I think although it's galactic consciousness, and so potentially it's infinite, I think it's at this time anyway, we're in this quarantine Earth, it's actually a finite quanta of consciousness, which is restricted to the human organism, the species. And so this consciousness, the more it flows into those who are resonating with truth, the less consciousness there is for those who are not aligning. So the mass will go deeper and deeper into unconsciousness and denial and truth, while a very small few will begin to resonate more and more brightly with truth. And so I think there's a twin process occurring, which is evolutionary, devolutionary, but which is alchemical. And it's back to the egg and the omelets, really, you know, that there is this new form, this new, I think it is a form, well, for consciousness, but that its creation or its being birthed depends upon the destruction of the old form, which is humanity as we know it.
I'm glad you mentioned that kind of split, because that was something that I did want to get into regarding how, you know, this seems to take place at this specific point in time, where a few are very much involved in learning, growing, evolving, building, so to speak, on themselves, or trying to learn about themselves. And another crowd that seems to go totally into the opposite of this kind of more Dionysian, just enjoyment, pleasure, and games, entertainment, all that stuff. If we think about the kind of, or the nightmare scenario, I guess, if we don't recognize the importance of the internal, what do you think the consequences of that will be for those who try to push this to the side, so to speak? Is there a nightmare scenario here? I mean, will we go into this control grid that you mentioned before, where we might be able to see transhumanism as the next step of the so-called human being? Or what do you think this might end up at the end?
Well, yes, I think that the split that we're talking about, it may be a very literal split, but quite unfathomable to our minds at this time, because we think that we're in reality, that what we're experiencing now is reality rather than the one particular tunnel that we've created, a Bardo realm, you might even say, which is part of what it is, you know, that makes us in quarantine, where we're actually being purged of some condition, which you could call egomania or self-importance. And so I think that those who are willing to surrender their identities, their self-importance, and simply get with the program, just allow themselves to become expressions of the universal energy, they will accordingly be released from this holding pen and move into a whole new heaven and a new earth. And those who can't, well, I think there's two possible scenarios. One is that they will experience gnosis or awakening anyway and be destroyed by it, and then we would see the destruction of the species such as it is, except for very few, not through any sort of necessarily environmental cataclysm or global conspiracy or anything, but simply through the awakening of their own unconscious and being overwhelmed by all of that disowned, unprocessed psychic matter. To have to go through all of that in a few moments, having spent a lifetime suppressing it, would be annihilating, wouldn't it? So either that would happen, or what you're talking about would be that it would be like two realities would be created. There would be a fork in reality, and on one earth, this new world order of total enslavement to the microchip and all of that scenario, which has been created, as I say, not only by the elite, but by those of us who've believed in this narrative and been propagating it, it's becoming more and more real as a possibility. And so eventually it would have to become a reality unless there was some global cataclysm which just brought it all to an end. So maybe this is a mercy for vast numbers of individuals who aren't ready for gnosis, for full awakening of their God natures, to spend another couple of thousand years as zombie slaves to a global elite. I really don't know, you know.
And in one sense, I also feel that it's their, and this might sound weird, but it's their right to have their experience as they see fit. And this returns to the idea that you were talking about later on, that if we think that we should be able to, you know, control how other people should live their lives in that sense, that, oh, no, you got to wake up, you know, you got to look at these all these important areas and realize how controlled you are, yada, yada, yada. We don't know at this point what the purpose of their experience might be, and in some sense, the joy that they might be experiencing, unbeknownst to all this other crap that is going on. And to me, it feels like already there we have a split, so to speak, with these two very, very different systems. Obviously, there is a gray area here as well, where, you know, it isn't this dichotomy as clear as that. But I definitely see that there's two different sides already here. And if these just increase and increase as we go along, I think it's a natural next step, so to speak, to just see these very two distinct and different sides, basically.
Well, it's really it is impossible to say, isn't it, to predict the way things are going within the next few decades. I just feel that it is absolutely critical now for the species, the kind of make or break period.
Yes.
And again, I mean, there's no way to take on the responsibility of awakening humanity, and because, as you pointed out, that may not be what humanity wants or needs. We can only try and frame our discoveries and our perceptions of what's going on in a way that is personal and individual to ourselves, and then act accordingly.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely, and because otherwise that would also imply that we're saying that everyone is just the same, and are on a soul or spiritual level, we might be of very different qualities or properties of this universal force that kind of runs throughout. And the purpose here might be for this diversity of multiple experiences. And if we think about it already, or at least from my point of view, it's incredible how different people seem to experience certain events and situations. And it's a multitude of different truths and versions of reality that they're kind of coexist on the same planet at the same time, which is quite interesting in itself. And that brings me to another question, Aelos, that you were talking about. You were talking about a new heaven and a new earth before, that is a possibility here. When you say that, do you think that we're talking about another place physically, or do you think that these two different systems that we're talking about can actually coexist on the same planet?
I guess we'd have to be talking about parallel universes at this point, in terms of if we're going to try and keep it within what we think we know about reality. That would be the only scientific model I can think of which would somehow account for what I perceive happening here. But the thing is that I have a very strong visceral sense, and I've had it since I was a child, that, as I've already said, that what we perceive of as reality is not reality, that we are actually in a kind of matrix, a kind of illusory realm which has been created, not by machines, but by very powerful beings who were once human, who have forged a pact with what Carlos Castaneda terms the inorganic beings, in order to, it's basically a trade-off that the inorganic beings get to farm us and get to feed off our emotions, and the old seers get a kind of immortality and a kind of total power and total control, and they get to avoid the terrifying revelation of death, of their karmic upcoming or comeuppance, by sustaining this illusory realm in which they can be lords and masters. And I know that, I mean, this is a very tricky tricky area, something that I'm going into in my very last podcast, because it doesn't get talked about very much, and yet there's a lot of clues to suggest that, outlandish as this scenario is, that it may well be closer to the truth than any of these conspiracy theories and Illuminati agendas. That, I mean, within that light, that all of these narratives would just be more distraction. They would just be more spellcraft to divert us from the true situation, which is that reality itself has been hijacked and is being controlled, and that we're not really part of what we think of as reality at all. It's like we've been contained in this bubble, in this dream world. Whatever we have to do to wake up to that, that would seem to be a natural, it seems to me that power, there's a kind of natural system in the universe where power assumes dominance wherever it can, and it's a way of testing those of us who are actually really able to claim our power as individual beings, creative divine beings, will naturally begin to move outside of this illusory realm that we've been confined to. And I think that that's a very, very few of us, is what I feel. I mean, we're talking about the world situation and all the rest of it, and I just wonder, you know, we take so much for granted, even, you know, people like you and I who go into these areas, we discover more and more strange ideas, and we try to weave them together, as I say, into a narrative, into a paradigm, but we can't really. All we can do is kind of extend and transform the one we've already been handed down to as children. And it's predicated on these basic assumptions, which we can't really question. But I think that we absolutely have to question everything.
Yes.
And so one thing I'd question, and which I do in my last podcast, is do we even know that there's 6 billion individuals on this planet? How do we know that there aren't just a very, very small number of us who are being farmed for our magical ability and kept asleep as magical beings by these secret, hidden sorcerers? And that the rest of the world and all these billions of people that we think are real are just created as an illusion, as a matrix to distract us and keep us from finding each other and organizing. And I know how utterly outlandish that sounds, but I've reached a point in life where I really have to consider not just anything, but I mean, I think only the really truly outlandish scenarios are actually adequate to deal with what we're undergoing now as a species, or certainly what I'm undergoing as an individual. I have to reach for ever larger and more unusual interpretations of reality simply in order to find a context for the stuff that I'm experiencing personally.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I think that that's also a carrot, if you will, that kind of keeps you looking into new areas. There is an excitement that of a mystery that cannot, well, at least it's very, very difficult to kind of solve and really, really know in that sense. But I understand what you're saying, definitely. I mean, I've had that experience many, many times, the kind of Truman Show sense of reality. I'm walking around in a set. The bodies are sims or even, you know, clones walking around for my own, maybe not enjoyment, but you know, it's an empty shell. It looks real, you know, but it's not really. And I think that that's also is actually a process in a way that we go through. But then at the end, of course, that might be the ultimate reality. As you pointed out, we simply don't know at this point. I think that I would agree with you in that sense the potential idea that we are being controlled by another race is very, very plausible in that sense. I would probably not go down the scary route, though. My idea that I got when you were describing this, that I get the sensation that we are these beings. We are the higher personalities, spirits, whatever you want to call it, on another plane. But we are playing the computer game here. We have gone into this interface, if you will, and we are now experiencing a lesser reality, a more limited reality, and it's nothing more than a computer game. I don't know if these beings are bored, so they just want to escape for a while, or what the score is here. But that's another interesting idea, and I think that it dovetails a little bit with your idea, Elas, but it might not be as scary, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, perhaps not as malevolent anyway. I think that there's nothing more terrifying to our personal identities than this idea that that nothing is real, that there's absolutely nothing that we can depend upon, and indeed that we don't really exist in the way that we think we exist, that our identities are actually these constructions that have been designed to enslave us. I don't think there's any way of avoiding the terror of that revelation, but I think it would be a mistake to assume that simply because something is frightening and threatening, it means that it's malevolent. I don't really acknowledge the existence of evil in the universe. Once again, I think this is to do with disowning an aspect of ourselves, and so it becomes autonomous, and then that is to all intents and purposes an evil presence, but it is only, once again, our own, it's being filtered through our own identity selves that has rendered it that way. Essentially, the universe is energy. Everything is energy. So you might have areas of blockage or even distortion that results from blockage, but how does that give rise to evil as such? I don't really accept that. I think that's a concatenation of the human mind once again.
I don't know if you've heard our programs that we've done with Jim Elvidge. He talks about this idea that our reality is literally a program running, in that sense, a matrix-esque type of scenario. But he elaborated on a few interesting ideas that is related to the fact that science might actually be able to kind of solve this or peer beneath the veil of this, of the programmed reality. He mentioned a few examples of a few particle accelerators and things like this that discover the clock cycle, if you will, of the of reality, basically, where we can see that something else, it isn't just, you know, not something isn't right here, so to speak. I don't know if you heard that or not, but do you think that that we will ever come closer to something like that, a revelation like that, in terms of science? Do you think that this puzzle, I guess, can be solved, and we can discover or learn more about the world beyond and these beings that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think we're definitely on the verge of that, and I think that science, once again, is not exactly a red herring, but it can be, in the sense that science is allowing us to acknowledge possibilities and discover our own potential, if you will, but that it's not actually a route to the truth in itself. A science, of course, just means knowledge. And knowledge is a relationship between things. And so I think that science is a way, as I say, to formulate new possibilities, but not a way to actually relate to those possibilities, because if we're using science, it always seems to lead to technology, doesn't it? And that's where the problem comes in, I think. Not that technology is wrong in itself, but that if we forget that it's just a tool for learning. I've used the metaphor of the abacus. You know, an abacus is a way to learn to count, and then once you've learn to count, you put away the abacus. And I think all technology is of this nature, and that would include the internet, which is a very obvious example of a technology which seems entirely benevolent and which is empowering us as individuals and allowing us to connect. But it may not last much longer. It may get taken away tomorrow for all we know. And so the thing to remember is that this is anything that we can accomplish through instruments, we can achieve with the human body itself. The human body is actually capable of anything we can do technologically. I'm convinced of that. That would include teleportation and time travel and you name it. As the human body is a vessel that's created by consciousness, then it can actually return to its original form as consciousness, which would, as a vehicle, would be plasma, I suppose, a body of light. And that, I think that's always been our only true option as human beings. You know, the only worthwhile pursuit is to develop the body of light, to develop the energy body, and to enter into a consciousness which isn't localized to the personal identity, and which it isn't contained within the entropy barrier of death. We actually can travel beyond the gates of death within the energy body. And so the fact that we're on the verge of this, these kind of possibilities through science, lets me know that our time has run out, in the sense, because if if the individuals we've seen running our world who don't take responsibility for their own darkness, who are simply interested in self-aggrandizement and power and control, and in avoiding at all costs the truth of themselves, and I mean, that's my perception. We're talking about networks of power that include satanic ritual abuse and paedophilia and all the rest of it. I think it's fair to assume that these are not enlightened individuals. So if we think about these people attaining that sort of power, well, at that point, I think divine intervention becomes an inevitability, because it's like, it's just too much. I don't really know how to describe it. I get just this instinctive sense that something has to give at that point. We've run out of time, because if we don't find this power within ourselves, then those who are least worthy of it are going to wield it, and they will, of course, destroy us, destroy everything.
And will they wield it through the aid of science and technology?
Yeah, well, I think that they have been. I think that the mummy and the Egyptians had, you know, this very mysterious technology, and the mummification was part of that. It was a part of an awareness that there would be the possibility in the future of cloning, of creating a physical replica of a body through the DNA, and that some of these Egyptian pharaohs, who would be the old seers of Kars Castaneda, were fully aware of this possibility, and that they've been waiting in the astral realms, if you will, in their energy bodies, for the time where these pharaohs could be cloned, and then they could actually literally reincarnate and be able to navigate the physical realm again. I think we're talking about some really mind-boggling concepts that are at work behind the scenes here, which do involve technology and sorcery and a blend of the two. And it is these individuals, they don't have any choice, Henry, because they have basically driven themselves into a corner. They can't simply surrender, because they've gone too far. And for them to surrender to spirit, to life, whatever, they would then have to deal with all the consequences of their actions, and that is terrifying for them. So the only chance they have is to somehow maintain their power base and have a simulation of immortality for as long as possible, and to keep the truth out. And
did you see that piece of news where this team of scientists successfully had extracted DNA from a mummy? Do you see that?
Yeah, I heard about that, absolutely.
You think that also has something to do with it, that there might potentially want to try to clone whatever it was that was enwrapped here in the shroud?
Well, yeah, I think, again, it's tricky. One doesn't want to get distracted by these discoveries, because they become so fascinating that one can just lose the thread of what really matters. But I really think that, yes, this kind of stuff is going on. Unimaginable manipulations of technology and sorcery over thousands of years, and that there is this incredibly elaborate, intricate agenda, which is kind of theater, really. It's the Armageddon theater that is playing out, using absolutely everything at their disposal, and that the technology, you see, we don't know. I mean, they're talking about cloning now. To my mind, that means that they were probably they'd probably figured out cloning 50 years ago, and that they've been doing it covertly for decades. I think that that's a fairly reasonable, maybe not assumption, but definitely a possibility. So, it's a question of how much, as I say, how much we want to really fixate on the designs of these controllers, and on the idea that they are all-powerful and that they have got plans for us and all the rest of it. I don't think that that's productive at all. I think that it's actually counterproductive because, as I mentioned in my notes to you for this chat, this idea of the placebo effect is one that is not, I haven't heard it, it's not being considered in the disclosures about these agendas, but everybody knows the placebo effect. This is if you're given a sugar pill and told that it's an aspirin, then it will cure your headache. So, you know, the power of the individual consciousness to affect one's own nervous system is unmapped. We really don't know, you know, the limits of that, if there indeed are any limits. Somebody under hypnosis will resist a burn or experience a burn from something that isn't hot. They can see through walls. Our potential, you know, is untapped. And so with the placebo effect, what I would, you know, what has occurred to me recently is that it may well be that a lot of these narratives that we're being fed and that then we're propagating are actually a way to consolidate the power of the people that we are supposedly exposing by actually increasing our belief in what they're doing, their methods, so that we will do it then to ourselves. If we're being told that this foodstuff or this substance is bad for us, then, and yet we have no choice but to consume it, then we're actually going to harm our nervous systems with that fear and that worry and that concern. And so, you know, we're constantly being kept hopping from one thought or one belief to another, aren't we? When it comes to food is a good example. When we're told that butter's bad for us, then we're told to take, you know, soy butter or margarine, and then they tell us, no, that's no good, and then they go to hydrogenated fats or whatever, and so on. And then finally they bring you back to butter and say, no, actually butter's the best thing. So we're constantly, you know what I mean? We're constantly kept sort of on this razor's edge of not knowing what we can do and what's actually going to harm us. And it really scrambles our thought processes. We're constantly on the defensive. And I think that this is
sorry to cut you off there, Alice, but I totally agree with you. And this is the way that they play the game, so to speak. This is the roller coaster ride that we're taken on. And as long as we don't educate ourselves and come to our own point of view, that is when we will be drawn into these types of discussion regarding what is bad for us, what is good for us, and this kind of flip-flopping going on that you, and then you're maybe try a new method or whatever, but then you still have a kind of in the back of your head a stress over this fact that, oh my God, what if this also turns out to be a fraud or a joke or, you know, even bad for me, you know, and hence we're being kept more sick, we're being kept more susceptible to propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. One thing after another kind of falls into place after this initial kind of stress and, where we're being played in this game. And this is, I think, ultimately that we just need to, as you mentioned before, we need to disengage from this game, this theater, this ride that we're taking on in that sense, and take our own responsibility, get informed ourselves, and find comfort in our own knowledge about a certain thing. You know, doubt is good on one sense as well, but also a sense of security that, okay, I've done what I can in order to read up on a subject, and then find some kind of relief in that, if you will.
Yeah, well, I think it is knowledge in that sense, and research really is valid, as you put it, to provide relief, because we have, our body knows everything, I believe, that at a bodily level we're aware of everything that is going on. And that includes all the different forms of sabotage in our food, of course, specifically in the microwaves and all of that, but also just everything that's going on with the species. And so this is creating an almost unimaginable pressure within the conscious mind and in the identity structure of all of this unacknowledged truth that is moving under the surface, whether it's plotting against us or whether it's simply emerging, trying to emerge through us. I think it's a bit of both. And so, yeah, we do need the tools by which to understand in a limited way and to maybe communicate and express what it is that we perceive is happening. And that will kind of relieve some of the pressure, like a safety valve, and maybe create a wider context so that then we can allow more of that unconscious knowing to emerge and process more and so on and so forth. I mean, knowledge in a way is the name of the game. It's just that once again, like technology, it's a tool.
Yes.
It's not an end in itself. And that's the distinction I would make.
Also, this idea that you mentioned before, I just briefly like to touch upon that. It's very interesting that you say that it's through, and if this is indeed what you're saying, that it's through us that we are keeping this control structure going, in a sense. I think even David Icke has elaborated on this particular idea that it's through our, I don't know exactly how the function of this actually works, but it could be through our unconscious or conscious mind that we what we focus on becomes manifest in a way. What we focus on become real. So if we think that they have control, they will consequently have control. This is how the game is being played on the occult level, that just give them the illusion that we are in, you know, have full power and there's nothing you can do, because these opportunities, so to speak, will actually manifest for us in the, you know, in the, if we're talking about from the perspective of those who are trying to control the game. And that might be a key in all this, in the game here, so to speak, and not to let ourselves be drawn into this. And in that sense, I guess that we come back to your initial kind of, you said that you don't want to use the word critique, but we come back to that idea that you were talking about before, that through us, in a way, and through what we focus on, we're still participatory in this game and making it a possibility. Would you say that that's right?
Yeah, I would. I think it's like we're being drawn into a theater without quite realizing it, and it's not the narrative that we would have chosen for ourselves. We're having to play the particular roles that have been laid down for us, whether it's the role of the activist or the conspiracy theorist or the occultist or the hippie. These are all roles that have actually been pre-designed so that they will be compatible with the theatre, the narrative that's being fostered by these few who wish to maintain power. And so by this method, they are, although they're allowing us to feel like players, they're making sure that we're really more or less reading the lines that we've been given. And this actually has the opposite effect to what we think. We're actually making the narrative stronger because we're becoming engaged in it. We're investing in it. And so bring it back to my initial metaphor about the dots. It's like we're filling in the blanks. If you think about a group of controllers, you could talk about nuts and bolts global elite, or you could even talk about the old seers who are forging a reality using our sleeping minds, our dreaming consciousness. They can't be absolutely on it. They can't control every single element of reality. They need us to fill in the blanks, to paper over the cracks. And so, but what they can do is they can, if they can control certain key joints of the system, certain key areas, then basically they will create a context within which we will have very limited movement. And so if we're unaware, like the majority, if we're oblivious and we're not actually making choices anyway, we will actually cooperate with that system, which is a fairly tight but still somewhat open grid of control. The unconscious masses will simply walk, don't walk, shop, don't shop. They will stay exactly according to the lines that are mapped. On the other hand, those of us who do become conscious and do have that possibility to move between the areas of control, if we focus too much on what we're perceiving as this control grid, the danger is that we actually fill in the blanks. We say, well, look, they control that. They control the food supply. They control the airwaves. They use TV. So they must control everything. So we just fill in those gaps. And then we end up being controlled, actually allowing ourselves to be controlled where we don't need to be, such as with the placebo effect. If they spread the idea through conspiracy circles that drinking bottled water is going to make us sterile, or whatever the latest thing is, then they don't even have, it doesn't even have to be true. You know, they could put the poisons in for the first few weeks and just get that meme going. And then once enough people believe it, they can just sit back and we'll do the rest ourselves, you know, with our own psyches, our own consciousness. We'll actually perform that function. So it is a very sophisticated occult process. And it really is just a matter of becoming aware of this possibility, along with all the other possibilities. And so at that point, we can really start playing our own roles. I mean, we can enter into the theater, enter into the narrative, but in a much more free form, more of a trickster mode, more playful, and say, okay, this is the narrative, don't much like it, but at the same time, it's pretty ingenious, got to admire it. You know, what can I do here? I'm going to be a disruptive agent in some form or another, but without, it has to be unexpected, I think. It has to be something that hasn't already been factored into the narrative already. So something that actually is going to hijack that narrative and take it down whole new channels. I think this is what we need to be doing now, and this is what I haven't seen enough of, and which I realized that we can't necessarily do it by talking about it, because as I say, we're just being given all this stuff and then we run with it. But we need to take the time just to go inward and just to find our own individual inner truth and then bring that to the narrative. I think that's the only way, rather than looking outside for clues.
All right. Very good words, I think. Good suggestions, definitely for consideration. I've really enjoyed this conversation, Elias, and I think that this is a good time here to begin to round things up. Interesting hearing from your perspective on reality and this experience that we're in. And I also want to say, of course, good luck with the book, the writing process, and let me know if you'd like to come back whenever you're ready and we can talk more about it, you know?
Well, thanks, Henrik. Yeah, anytime. Just give me the word.
Absolutely. Leave us with your websites again, although you probably not will be updating them here then in a couple of while, but I guess that people can in a while, but people will be able to reach you for a while at least through your email address on the website, right?
Well, yeah, I'll give my email address. How about that? It's aos underscore kfus at yahoo.com.
That's better. Spell that for us, Aos.
Okay, A-E-O, do I know how to spell my own name? A-E-O-L-U-S underscore K-E-P-H-A-S. Yes. I suppose I should probably mention, at yahoo.com.
Sorry. Very good, yeah.
I suppose I ought to mention, for the sake of my publishers, that they're putting together my latest book, which is called Homo Sapiens, an occult history of DNA from Eden to Armageddon, and that is from Adventures Unlimited Press, and I'm hoping that will be ready later in the year for release.
Through Alternative Press, or will you do a blog post on it so we know when it's out?
It's Adventures Unlimited Press. Who knows if I'll be blogging again by then, but I guess time will tell.
Time will tell, indeed. Thank you very much for joining us, Elias. We'll stay in contact and we'll hope to talk more with you soon.
Thank you, Henry. Be well.
That's our program with Elias Kefas. Thank you very much for joining us here in the member section. Great to have you along. We will be back soon with more radio and webcasts, all for your consideration, that we hope will add to your perspective and expand your view of reality. My name is Henrik. My thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. Take good care of yourself, and we will talk more soon.